Chapter 12. The Adventures of the Old Woman Continued.
Astonished and delighted to hear my native language, and no less surprised at what this man said, I made answer that there were much greater misfortunes than that of which he complained. I told him in a few words of the horrors which I had endured, and fainted a second time. He carried me to a neighboring house, put me to bed, gave me food, waited upon me, consoled me, flattered me. He told me that he had never seen anyone so beautiful as I, and that he never so much regretted the loss of what it was impossible to recover. "I was born at Naples," said he. "There they geld 2,000 or 3,000 children every year. Some die of the operation, others acquire a voice more beautiful than that of women, and others are raised to offices of state. This operation was performed on me with great success, and I was chapel musician to Madame, the Princess of Palestrina."
"Oh, to my mother!" cried I.
"Your mother?" cried he, weeping. "What? Can you be that young princess whom I brought up until the age of 6 years, and who promised so early to be as beautiful as you?"
"It is I, indeed. But my mother lies 400 yards hence, torn in quarters, under a heap of dead bodies."
Ah, oh, I told him all my adventures, and he made me acquainted with his, telling me that he had been sent to the Emperor of Morocco by a Christian power to conclude a treaty with that prince, in consequence of which he was to be furnished with military stores and ships to help to demolish the commerce of other Christian governments.
"My mission is done," said this honest eunuch. "I go to embark for Ceuta, and will take you to Italy. Ma che sciagura d'essere senza coglioni!" Ah, I thanked him with tears of commiseration. But instead of taking me to Italy, he conducted me to Algiers, where he sold me to the governor. Oh, scarcely was I sold than the plague which had made the tour of Africa, Asia, and Europe broke out with great malignancy in Algiers. You have seen earthquakes, but pray, miss, have you ever had the plague?"
"Never,"
answered Cunegonde.
"If you had," said the old woman, "you would acknowledge that it is far more terrible than an earthquake. It is common in Africa, and I caught it. Imagine to yourself the distressed situation of the daughter of a pope, only 15 years old, who in less than 3 months had felt the miseries of poverty and slavery, had been ravished almost every day, had beheld her mother drawn in quarters, had experienced famine and war, and was dying of the plague in Algiers. I did not die, however, but my eunuch and the governor and almost the whole seraglio of Algiers perished. As soon as the first fury of this terrible pestilence was over, a sale was made of the governor's slaves. I was purchased by a merchant and carried to Tunis. This man sold me to another merchant, who sold me again to another at Tripoli. From Tripoli I was sold to Alexandria, from Alexandria to Smyrna, and from Smyrna to Constantinople. At length I became the property of an aga of the Janissaries, who was soon ordered away to the defense of Azov, then besieged by the Russians. The aga, who was a very gallant man, took his whole seraglio with him and lodged us in a small fort on the Palos Meotides, guarded by 2 black eunuchs and 20 soldiers. The Turks killed prodigious numbers of the Russians, but the latter had their revenge. Azov was destroyed by fire, the inhabitants put to the sword, neither sex nor age was spared, until there remained only our little fort, and the enemy wanted to starve us out. The 20 Janissaries had sworn they would never surrender. The extremities of famine to which they were reduced obliged them to eat our 2 eunuchs for fear of violating their oath. And at the end of a few days, they resolved also to devour the women. We had a very pious and humane imam who preached an excellent sermon exhorting them not to kill us all at once. "Only cut off one buttock of each of those ladies," said he, "and you'll fare extremely well. If you must go to it again, there will be the same entertainment a few days hence. Heaven will accept of so charitable an action and send you relief." He had great eloquence. He persuaded them. We underwent this terrible operation. The Iman applied the same balsam to us as he does to children after circumcision, and we all nearly died. Scarcely had the Janissaries finished the repast with which we had furnished them, than the Russians came in flat-bottomed boats. Not a Janissary escaped. The Russians paid no attention to the condition we were in. There are French surgeons in all parts of the world. One of them, who was very clever, took us under his care. He cured us. And as long as I live, I shall remember that as soon as my wounds were healed, he made proposals to me. He bid us all be of good cheer, telling us that the like had happened in many sieges, and that it was according to the laws of war. As soon as my companions could walk, they were obliged to set out for Moscow. I fell to the share of a boyard, who made me his gardener, and gave me 20 lashes a day. But this nobleman, having in 2 years' time been broke upon the wheel along with 30 more boyards for some broils at court, I profited by that event. I fled. I traversed all Russia. I was a long time an inholder's servant at Riga, the same at Rostock, at Wismar, at Leipzig, at Kassel, at Utrecht, at Leiden, at The Hague, at Rotterdam. I waxed old in misery and disgrace, having only one half of my posteriors, and always remembering I was a pope's daughter. 100 times I was upon the point of killing myself, but still I loved life. This ridiculous foible is perhaps one of our most fatal characteristics. For is there anything more absurd than to wish to carry continually a burden which one can always throw down? To detest existence, and yet to cling to one's existence? In brief, to caress the serpent which devours us till he has eaten our very heart? In the different countries which it has been my lot to traverse, and the numerous inns where I have been servant, I have taken notice of a vast number of people who held their own existence in abhorrence, and yet I never knew of more than 8 who voluntarily put an end to their misery. 3 Negroes, 4 Englishmen, and a German professor named Robeck. I ended by being servant to the Jew, Don Issachar, who placed me near your presence, my fair lady. I am determined to share your fate, and have been much more affected with your misfortunes than with my own. I would never even have spoken to you of my misfortunes had you not piqued me a little, and if it were not customary to tell stories on board a ship in order to pass away the time. In short, Miss Cunegonde, I have had experience. I know the world. Therefore, I advise you to divert yourself, and prevail upon each passenger to tell his story. And if there be one of them all that has not cursed his life many a time, that has not frequently looked upon himself as the unhappiest of mortals, I give you leave to throw me head foremost into the sea.
Chapter 13. How Candide was forced away from his fair Cunegonde and the old woman. The beautiful Cunegonde, having heard the old woman's history, paid her all the civilities due to a person of her rank and merit. She likewise accepted her proposal, and engaged all the passengers, one after the other, to relate their adventures. And then both she and Candide allowed that the old woman was in the right. "It is a great pity," said Candide, "that the sage Pangloss was hanged, contrary to custom, at an auto da fe. He would tell us most amazing things in regard to the physical and moral evils that overspread earth and sea, and I should be able, with due respect, to make a few objections." While each passenger was recounting his story, the ship made her way. They landed at Buenos Aires. Cunegonde, Captain Candide, and the old woman waited on the governor, Don Fernando de Ibarra y Figuera y Mascarenhas y Lampurros y Sousa. This nobleman had a stateliness becoming a person who bore so many names. He spoke to men with so noble a disdain, carried his nose so loftily, raised his voice so unmercifully, assumed so imperious an air, and stalked with such intolerable pride that those who saluted him were strongly inclined to give him a good drubbing. Cunegonde appeared to him the most beautiful he had ever met. The first thing he did was to ask whether she was not the captain's wife. The manner in which he asked the question alarmed Candide. He durst not say she was his wife, because indeed she was not. Neither durst he say she was his sister, because it was not so. And although this obliging lie had been formerly much in favour among the ancients, and although it could be useful to the moderns, his soul was too pure to betray the truth. "Miss Cunegonde," said he, "is to do me the honour to marry me, and we beseech your excellency to deign to sanction our marriage." Don Fernando de Ibarra y Figuera y Mascarenhas y Lampurdos y Sousa, turning up his mustachios, smiled mockingly, and ordered Captain Candide to go and review his company. Candide obeyed, and the governor remained alone with Miss Cunegonde. He declared his passion, protesting he would marry her the next day in the face of the church, or otherwise just as should be agreeable to herself. Cunegonde asked a quarter of an hour to consider of it, to consult the old woman, and to take her resolution. The old woman spoke thus to Cunegonde.
"Miss, you have 72 quarterings, and not a farthing. It is now in your power to be wife to the greatest lord in South America, who has very beautiful mustachios. Is it for you to pique yourself upon inviolable fidelity? You have been ravished by Bulgarians. A Jew and an inquisitor have enjoyed your favours. Misfortune gives sufficient excuse. I own that if I were in your place, I should have no scruple in marrying the governor and in making the fortune of Captain Candide."
While the old woman spoke with all the prudence which age and experience gave, a small ship entered the port, on board of which were an alcalde and his alguacils, and this was what happened. As the old woman had shrewdly guessed, it was a grey friar who stole Cunegonde's money and jewels in the town of Badajoz when she and Candide were escaping. The friar wanted to sell some of the diamonds to a jeweller. The jeweller knew them to be the Grand Inquisitor's. The friar, before he was hanged, confessed he had stolen them. He described the individuals involved and the route they had taken. The flight of Cunegonde and Candide was already known. They were traced to Cadiz. A vessel was immediately sent in pursuit of them. The vessel was already in the port of Buenos Aires. The report spread that the alcalde was going to land, and that he was in pursuit of the murderers of my lord the Grand Inquisitor. The prudent old woman saw at once what was to be done.
"You cannot run away," said she to Cunegonde, "and you have nothing to fear, for it was not you that killed my lord. Besides, the governor who loves you will not suffer you to be ill-treated. Therefore, stay."
Cunegonde then ran immediately to Candide.
"Fly," said she, "or in an hour you will be burnt."
There was not a moment to lose. But how could he part from Cunegonde, and where could he flee for shelter? Chapter 14. How Candide and Cacambo were received by the Jesuits of Paraguay. Candide had brought such a valet with him from Cadiz as one often meets with on the coasts of Spain and in the American colonies. He was a quarter Spaniard, born of a mongrel in Tucuman. He had been singing boy, sacristan, sailor, monk, peddler, soldier, and lackey. His name was Cacambo, and he loved his master because his master was a very good man. He quickly saddled the two Andalusian horses.
"Come, master. Let us follow the old woman's advice. Let us start and run without looking behind us."
Candide shed tears.
"Oh, my dear Cunegonde, must I leave you just at the time when the governor was going to sanction our nuptials? Cunegonde, brought to such a distance, what will become of you?
"Ah, she will do as well as she can," said Cacambo. "The women are never at a loss. God provides for them. Let us run."
"Whither art thou carrying me? Where shall we go? What shall we do without Cunegonde?" said Candide.
"By St. James of Compostela," said Cacambo, "you were going to fight against the Jesuits. Let us go to fight for them. I know the road well. I'll conduct you to their kingdom, where they will be charmed to have a captain that understands the Bulgarian exercise. You make a prodigious fortune. If we cannot find our account in one world, we shall in another. It's a great pleasure to see and do new things."
"You have before been in Paraguay, then?" said Candide.
"Sure," answered Cacambo. "I was servant in the College of the Assumption, and am acquainted with the government of the good fathers as well as I am with the streets of Cadiz. Oh, it's an admirable government. The kingdom is upwards of 300 leagues in diameter, and divided into 30 provinces. There the fathers possess all, and the people nothing. It's a masterpiece of reason and justice. For my part, I see nothing so divine as the fathers who here made war upon the kings of Spain and Portugal, and in Europe confess those kings, who here kill Spaniards, and in Madrid send them to heaven. Oh, this delights me. Let us push forward. You're going to be the happiest of mortals. What pleasure will it be to those fathers to hear that a captain who knows the Bulgarian exercise has come to them?"
As soon as they reached the first border, Cacambo told the advanced guard that a captain wanted to speak with my lord the commandant. Notice was given to the main guard, and immediately a Paraguayan officer ran and laid himself at the feet of the commandant to impart this news to him. Candide and Cacambo were disarmed, and the two Andalusian horses seized. The strangers were introduced between two files of musketeers. The commandant was at the further end, with a three-cornered cap on his head, his gown tucked up, a sword by his side, and a spike in his hand. He beckoned, and straightway the newcomers were encompassed by 24 soldiers. A sergeant told them they must wait, that the commandant could not speak to them, and that the Reverend Father Provincial does not suffer any Spaniard to open his mouth but in his presence, or to stay above 3 hours in the province.
"And where is the Reverend Father Provincial?" said Cacambo. "He is upon the parade just after celebrating Mass," answered the sergeant, "and you cannot kiss his spurs till 3 hours hence." "However," said Cacambo, "the captain is not a Spaniard, but a German. He is ready to perish with hunger as well as myself. Cannot we have something for breakfast while we wait for his reverence?"
The sergeant went immediately to acquaint the commandant with what he had heard.
"God be praised," said the Reverend Commandant. "Since he is a German, I may speak to him. Take him to my arbour."
Candide was at once conducted to a beautiful summer-house, ornamented with a very pretty colonnade of green and gold marble, and with trellises enclosing parakeets, hummingbirds, flybirds, guinea hens, and all other rare birds. An excellent breakfast was provided in vessels of gold, and while the Paraguayans were eating maize out of wooden dishes, in the open fields and exposed to the heat of the sun, the Reverend Father Commandant retired to his arbour. He was a very handsome young man, with a full face, white skin, but high in colour. He had an arched eyebrow, a lively eye, red ears, vermilion lips, a bold air, but such a boldness as neither belonged to a Spaniard nor a Jesuit. They returned their arms to Candide and Cacambo, and also the two Andalusian horses, to whom Cacambo gave some oats to eat just by the arbour, having an eye upon them all the while for fear of a surprise. Candide first kissed the hem of the commandant's robe, then they sat down to table.
"You are, then, a German?"
said the Jesuit to him in that language.
"Yes, Reverend Father," answered Candide.
As they pronounced these words, they looked at each other with great amazement, and with such an emotion as they could not conceal.
"And from what part of Germany do you come?"
said the Jesuit.
"I am from the dirty province of Westphalia," answered Candide. "I was born in the castle of Thunder Ten Tronc."
"Heavens! Is it possible?"
cried the commandant.
"What a miracle!" cried Candide.
"Is it really you?"
said the commandant.
"It is not possible," said Candide.
They drew back, they embraced, they shed rivulets of tears.
"What, is it you, Reverend Father? You, the brother of the fair Cunegonde? You that was slain by the Bulgarians? You, the Baron's son? You, a Jesuit in Paraguay?
I must confess, this is a strange world that we live in. Oh, Pangloss, Pangloss, how glad you would be if you had not been hanged.
The commandant sent away the negro slaves and the Paraguayans, who served them with liquors in goblets of rock crystal. He thanked God and St. Ignatius 1,000 times. He clasped Candide in his arms, and their faces were all bathed with tears.
You will be more surprised, more affected and transported, said Candide, when I tell you that Cunegonde, your sister, whom you believe to have been ripped open, is in perfect health.
Where?
In your neighbourhood, with the governor of Buenos Aires, and I was going to fight against you.
Every word which they uttered in this long conversation but added wonder to wonder. Their souls fluttered on their tongues, listened in their ears, and sparkled in their eyes. As they were Germans, they sat a good while at table, waiting for the Reverend Father Provincial, and the commandant spoke to his dear Candide as follows. Chapter 15. How Candide Killed the Brother of His Dear Cunegonde.
I shall have ever present to my memory the dreadful day on which I saw my father and mother killed, and my sister ravished. When the Bulgarians retired, my dear sister could not be found, but my mother, my father, and myself, with two maidservants and three little boys, all of whom had been slain, were put in a hearse to be conveyed for interment to a chapel belonging to the Jesuits, within 2 leagues of our family seat. A Jesuit sprinkled us with some holy water. It was horribly salt. A few drops of it fell into my eyes. The father perceived that my eyelids stirred a little. He put his hand upon my heart and felt it beat. I received assistance, and at the end of 3 weeks I recovered. You know, my dear Candide, I was very pretty. But I grew much prettier, and the Reverend Father Didrier, superior of that house, conceived the tenderest friendship for me. He gave me the habit of the order, and some years after I was sent to Rome. The Father General needed new levies of young German Jesuits. The sovereigns of Paraguay admit as few Spanish Jesuits as possible. They prefer those of other nations as being more subordinate to their commands. I was judged fit by the Reverend Father General to go and work in this vineyard. We set out, a Pole, a Tyrolese, and myself. Upon my arrival, I was honoured with a subdeaconship and a lieutenancy. I am today colonel and priest. We shall give a warm reception to the King of Spain's troops. I will answer for it that they shall be excommunicated and well beaten. Providence sends you here to assist us. But is it indeed true that my dear sister Cunegonde is in the neighbourhood with the governor of Buenos Aires?
Candide assured him on oath that nothing was more true, and their tears began afresh. The Baron could not refrain from embracing Candide. He called him his brother, his saviour.
Ah, perhaps, said he, we shall together, my dear Candide, enter the town as conquerors and recover my sister Cunegonde.
That is all I want, said Candide, for I intended to marry her, and I still hope to do so.
Ugh, you insolent, replied the Baron. Would you have the impudence to marry my sister, who has 72 quarterings? I find thou hast the most consummate effrontery to dare to mention so presumptuous a design.
Candide, petrified at this speech, made answer,
Reverend Father, all the quarterings in the world signify nothing. I rescued your sister from the arms of a Jew and of an inquisitor. She has great obligations to me. She wishes to marry me. Master Pangloss always told me that all men are equal, and certainly I will marry her. We shall see that, thou scoundrel, said the Jesuit Baron de Thundertentronck,
and that instant struck him across the face with the flat of his sword. Candide, in an instant, drew his rapier and plunged it up to the hilt in the Jesuit's belly. But in pulling it out, reeking hot, he burst into tears.
Good God, said he, I have killed my old master, my friend, my brother-in-law. Ah, I am the best-natured creature in the world, and yet I have already killed 3 men, and of those 3, 2 were priests.
Cacambo, who stood sentry by the door of the arbour, ran to him.
"Oh, we have nothing more for it than to sell our lives as dearly as we can," said his master to him. "Without doubt someone will soon enter the arbour, and we must die sword in hand."
Cacambo, who had been in a great many scrapes in his lifetime, did not lose his head. He took the baron's Jesuit habit, put it on Candide, gave him the square cap, and made him mount on horseback. All this was done in the twinkling of an eye.
"Let us gallop fast, master. Everybody will take you for a Jesuit, going to give directions to your men, and we shall have passed the frontiers before they will be able to overtake us."
He flew as he spoke these words, crying out aloud in Spanish, "Make way! Make way for the Reverend Father Colonel!" Chapter 16. Adventures of the Two Travellers, with Two Girls, Two Monkeys, and the Savages Called Orellons. Candide and his valet had got beyond the border before it was known in the camp that the German Jesuit was dead. The wary Cacambo had taken care to fill his wallet with bread, chocolate, bacon, fruit, and a few bottles of wine. With their Andalusian horses they penetrated into an unknown country, where they perceived no beaten track. At length they came to a beautiful meadow intersected with purling streams. Here our two adventurers fed their horses. Cacambo proposed to his master to take some food, and he set him an example.
"How can you ask me to eat ham?" said Candide, "after killing the baron's son, and being doomed never more to see the beautiful Cunegonde? What will it avail me to spin out my wretched days and drag them far from her in remorse and despair? And what will the journal of Trevoux say?"
While Candide was thus lamenting his fate, Cacambo went on eating. The sun went down. The two wanderers heard some little cries, which seemed to be uttered by women. They did not know whether they were cries of pain or joy. But they started up precipitately with that inquietude and alarm which every little thing inspires in an unknown country. The noise was made by two naked girls who tripped along the mead, while two monkeys were pursuing them and biting their buttocks. Candide was moved with pity. He had learned to fire a gun in the Bulgarian service, and he was so clever at it that he could hit a hazelnut in a hedge without touching a leaf of the tree. He took up his double-barreled Spanish fusil, let it off, and killed the two monkeys.
"God be praised! My dear Cacambo, I have rescued those two poor creatures from a most perilous situation. If I have committed a sin in killing an inquisitor and a Jesuit, I have made ample amends by saving the lives of these girls. Perhaps they are young ladies of family, and this adventure may procure us great advantages in this country." He was continuing, but stopped short when he saw the two girls tenderly embracing the monkeys, bathing their bodies in tears, and rending the air with the most dismal lamentations. "Little did I expect to see such good nature," said he at length to Cacambo, who made answer,
"Master, you have done a fine thing now. You have slain the sweethearts of those two young ladies."
"The sweethearts? Is it possible? Oh, you're jesting, Cacambo. I can never believe it."
"Dear master," replied Cacambo, "you are surprised at everything. Why should you think it so strange that in some countries there are monkeys which insinuate themselves into the good graces of the ladies? They are a fourth part human, as I am a fourth part Spaniard."
"Alas," replied Candide, "I remember to have heard Master Pangloss say that formerly such accidents used to happen, that these mixtures were productive of centaurs, fauns, and satyrs, and that many of the ancients had seen such monsters, but I looked upon the whole as fabulous."
"You ought now to be convinced," said Cacambo, "that it is the truth, and you see what use is made of those creatures by persons that have not had a proper education. All I fear is that those ladies will play us some ugly trick."
These sound reflections induced Candide to leave the meadow and to plunge into a wood. He supped there with Cacambo, and after cursing the Portuguese inquisitor, the governor of Buenos Aires, and the baron, they fell asleep on moss. On awaking, they felt that they could not move, for during the night the Orellons, who inhabited that country and to whom the ladies had denounced them, had bound them with cords made of the bark of trees. They were encompassed by 50 naked Orellons, armed with bows and arrows, with clubs and flint hatchets. Some were making a large cauldron boil, others were preparing spits, and all cried,
A Jesuit! A Jesuit! We shall be revenged! We shall have excellent cheer! Let us eat the Jesuit! Let us eat him up!
Ah, I told you, my dear master, cried Cacambo sadly, that those two girls would play us some ugly trick.
Candide, seeing the cauldron and the spits, cried, We are certainly going to be either roasted or boiled. Ah, what would Master Pangloss say were he to see how pure nature is formed? Everything is right, maybe, but I declare it is very hard to have lost Miss Cunegonde and to be put upon a spit by Orellans.
Cacambo never lost his head. Do not despair, said he to the disconsolate Candide. I understand a little of the jargon of these people. I will speak to them.
Be sure, said Candide, to represent to them how frightfully inhuman it is to cook men, and how very unchristian.
Gentlemen, said Cacambo, you reckon you are today going to feast upon a Jesuit? It's all very well. Nothing is more proper than thus to treat your enemies. Indeed, the law of nature teaches us to kill our neighbour, and such is the practice all over the world. If we do not accustom ourselves to eating them, it is because we have better fare. But you have not the same resources as we. Certainly it is much better to devour your enemies than to resign to the crows and rooks the fruits of your victory. But, gentlemen, surely you would not choose to eat your friends, huh? You believe that you are going to spit a Jesuit. But he is your defender. It is the enemy of your enemies that you are going to roast. As for myself, I was born in your country. This gentleman is my master, and far from being a Jesuit, he has just killed one whose spoils he wears. And thence comes your mistake. To convince you of the truth of what I say, take this habit and carry it to the frontier of the Jesuit kingdom and inform yourselves whether my master did not kill a Jesuit officer. It will not take you long, and you can always eat us if you find that I have lied to you. But I have told you the truth. You're too well acquainted with the principles of public law, humanity, and justice not to pardon us.
The Oreans found this speech very reasonable. They deputed two of their principal people with all expedition to inquire into the truth of the matter. These executed their commission like men of sense, and soon returned with good news. The Oreans untied their prisoners, showed them all sorts of civilities, offered them girls, gave them refreshment, and reconducted them to the borders of their territories, proclaiming with great joy, "He is no Jesuit! He is no Jesuit!" Candide could not help being surprised at the cause of his deliverance. "What people," said he, "what men, what manners! If I had not been so lucky as to run Miss Cunegonde's brother through the body, I should have been devoured without redemption. But after all, pure nature is good, since these people, instead of feasting upon my flesh, have shown me 1,000 civilities when then I was not a Jesuit."
Chapter 17. Arrival of Candide and his valet at El Dorado, and what they saw there.
"You see," said Cacambo to Candide, as soon as they had reached the frontiers of the Oreans, "that this hemisphere is not better than the others, take my word for it. Let us go back to Europe by the shortest way."
"How go back?" said Candide. "And where shall we go? To my own country? The Bulgarians and the Abares are slaying all. To Portugal? There I shall be burnt. And if we abide here, we are every moment in danger of being spitted. But how can I resolve to quit a part of the world where my dear Cunegonde resides?"
"Ah, let us turn towards Cayenne," said Cacambo. "There we shall find Frenchmen who wander all over the world. They may assist us. God will perhaps have pity on us."
It was not easy to get to Cayenne. They knew vaguely in which direction to go, but rivers, precipices, robbers, savages obstructed them all the way. Their horses died of fatigue. Their provisions were consumed. They fed a whole month upon wild fruits, and found themselves at last near a little river bordered with cocoa trees, which sustained their lives and their hopes. Cacambo, who was as good a counsellor as the old woman, said to Candide,
"We are able to hold out no longer. We've walked enough. I see an empty canoe near the riverside.
Let us fill it with coconuts, throw ourselves into it, and go with the current. A river always leads to some inhabited spot. If we do not find pleasant things, we shall at least find new things."
"Ah, with all my heart," said Candide, "let us recommend ourselves to Providence."
They rowed a few leagues between banks, in some places flowery, in others barren, in some parts smooth, in others rugged. The stream ever widened, and at length lost itself under an arch of frightful rocks which reached to the sky. The two travellers had the courage to commit themselves to the current. The river, suddenly contracting at this place, whirled them along with a dreadful noise and rapidity. At the end of 24 hours they saw daylight again, but their canoe was dashed to pieces against the rocks. For a league they had to creep from rock to rock, until at length they discovered an extensive plain bounded by inaccessible mountains. The country was cultivated as much for pleasure as for necessity. On all sides the useful was also the beautiful. The roads were covered, or rather adorned, with carriages of a glittering form and substance, in which were men and women of surprising beauty, drawn by large red sheep, which surpassed in fleetness the finest coursers of Andalusia, Tutuan, and Mequinez. "Here, however, is a country," said Candide, "which is better than Westphalia." He stepped out with Cacambo towards the first village which he saw. Some children dressed in tattered brocades played at quoits on the outskirts. Our travellers from the other world amused themselves by looking on. The quoits were large round pieces, yellow, red, and green, which cast a singular lustre. The travellers picked a few of them off the ground. This was of gold, that of emeralds, the other of rubies. The least of them would have been the greatest ornament on the Mogul's throne.
"Without doubt," said Cacambo, "these children must be the king's sons that are playing at quoits."
The village schoolmaster appeared at this moment and called them to school.
"There," said Candide, "is the preceptor of the royal family."
The little urchins immediately quitted their game, leaving the quoits on the ground with all their other playthings. Candide gathered them up, ran to the master, and presented them to him in a most humble manner, giving him to understand by signs that their royal highnesses had forgotten their gold and jewels. The schoolmaster, smiling, flung them upon the ground. Then, looking at Candide with a good deal of surprise, went about his business. The travellers, however, took care to gather up the gold, the rubies, and the emeralds.
"Where are we?" cried Candide. "The king's children in this country must be well brought up, since they are taught to despise gold and precious stones."
Cacambo was as much surprised as Candide. At length they drew near the first house in the village. It was built like a European palace. A crowd of people pressed about the door, and there were still more in the house. They heard most agreeable music, and were aware of a delicious odour of cooking. Cacambo went up to the door and heard they were talking Peruvian. It was his mother tongue, for it is well known that Cacambo was born in Tucuman, in a village where no other language was spoken.
"I will be your interpreter here," he said to Candide. "Let us go in. It is a public house."
Immediately two waiters and two girls, dressed in cloth of gold and their hair tied up with ribbons, invited them to sit down to table with the landlord. They served 4 dishes of soup, each garnished with 2 young parrots, a boiled condor which weighed 200 pounds, 2 roasted monkeys of excellent flavour, 300 hummingbirds in 1 dish, and 600 flybirds in another. Exquisite ragouts, delicious pastries, the whole served up in dishes of a kind of rock crystal. The waiters and girls poured out several liqueurs drawn from the sugar cane. Most of the company were chapmen and wagoners, all extremely polite. They asked Cacambo a few questions with the greatest circumspection, and answered his in the most obliging manner. As soon as dinner was over, Cacambo believed, as well as Candide, that they might well pay their reckoning by laying down 2 of those large gold pieces which they had picked up. The landlord and landlady shouted with laughter and held their sides. When the fit was over,
"Gentlemen," said the landlord, "it is plain you are strangers, and such guests we are not accustomed to see. Pardon us, therefore, for laughing when you offered us the pebbles from our high roads in payment of your reckoning. You doubtless have not the money of the country, but it is not necessary to have any money at all to dine in this house. All hostelries established for the convenience of commerce are paid by the government. You have fared but very indifferently, because this is a poor village, but everywhere else you will be received as you deserve."
Cacumbo explained this whole discourse with great astonishment to Candide, who was as greatly astonished to hear it. "What sort of a country, then, is this?" said they to one another. "A country unknown to all the rest of the world, and where nature is of a kind so different from ours. It is probably the country where all is well, huh? For there absolutely must be one such place. And whatever Master Pangloss might say, I often found that things went very ill in Westphalia."
Chapter 18. What They Saw in the Country of El Dorado. Cacumbo expressed his curiosity to the landlord, who made answer,
"I am very ignorant, but not the worse on that account. However, we have in this neighbourhood an old man retired from court, who is the most learned and most communicative person in the kingdom."
At once he took Cacumbo to the old man. Candide acted now only as an onlooker, and accompanied his valet. They entered a very plain house, for the door was only of silver, and the ceilings were only of gold, but wrought in so elegant a taste as to vie with the richest. The antechamber, indeed, was only encrusted with rubies and emeralds, but the order in which everything was arranged made amends for this great simplicity. The old man received the strangers on his sofa, which was stuffed with hummingbirds' feathers, and ordered his servants to present them with liqueurs in diamond goblets, after which he satisfied their curiosity in the following terms.
"I am now 172 years old, and I learnt of my late father, master of the horse to the king, the amazing revolutions of Peru, of which he had been an eyewitness. The kingdom we now inhabit is the ancient country of the Incas, who quitted it very imprudently to conquer another part of the world, and were at length destroyed by the Spaniards. More wise by far were the princes of their family, who remained in their native country, and they ordained, with the consent of the whole nation, that none of the inhabitants should ever be permitted to quit this little kingdom, and this has preserved our innocence and happiness. The Spaniards have had a confused notion of this country, and have called it El Dorado. And an Englishman, whose name was Sir Walter Raleigh, came very near it about 100 years ago. But being surrounded by inaccessible rocks and precipices, we have hitherto been sheltered from the rapaciousness of European nations, who have an inconceivable passion for the pebbles and dirt of our land, for the sake of which they would murder us to the last man."
The conversation was long. It turned chiefly on their form of government, their manners, their women, their public entertainments, and the arts. At length Candide, having always had a taste for metaphysics, made Cacumbo ask whether there was any religion in that country. The old man reddened a little.
"How, then," said he, "can you doubt it? Do you take us for ungrateful wretches?"
Cacumbo humbly asked, "What was the religion in El Dorado?" The old man reddened again.
"Can there be two religions?" said he. "We have, I believe, the religion of all the world. We worship God night and morning."
"Do you worship but one God?" said Cacumbo,
who still acted as interpreter in representing Candide's doubts.
"Surely," said the old man, "there are not two, nor three, nor four. I must confess, the people from your side of the world ask very extraordinary questions."
Candide was not yet tired of interrogating the good old man. He wanted to know in what manner they prayed to God in El Dorado.
"We do not pray to him," said the worthy sage. "We have nothing to ask of him. He has given us all we need, and we return him thanks without ceasing."
Candide, having a curiosity to see the priests, asked where they were. The good old man smiled.
"Oh, my friend," said he, "we are all priests. The king and all the heads of families sing solemn canticles of thanksgiving every morning, accompanied by 5,000 or 6,000 musicians."
"What? Have you no monks who teach, who dispute, who govern, who plot and who burn people that are not of their opinion?"
"Oh, we must be mad indeed, if that were the case," said the old man. "Here we are all of one opinion, and we know not what you mean by monks."
During this whole discourse, Candide was in raptures, and he said to himself, "This is vastly different from Westphalia and the Baron's castle. Had our friend Pangloss seen El Dorado, he would no longer have said that the castle of Thundertentronckh was the finest upon earth. It is evident that one must travel." After this long conversation, the old man ordered a coach and 6 sheep to be got ready, and 12 of his domestics to conduct the travellers to court.
"Excuse me," said he, "if my age deprives me of the honour of accompanying you. The king will receive you in a manner that cannot displease you, and no doubt you will make an allowance for the customs of the country if some things should not be to your liking."
Candide and Cacambo got into the coach. The 6 sheep flew, and in less than 4 hours they reached the king's palace situated at the extremity of the capital. The portal was 220 feet high and 100 wide, but words are wanting to express the materials of which it was built. It is plain such materials must have prodigious superiority over those pebbles and sand which we call gold and precious stones. 20 beautiful damsels of the king's guard received Candide and Cacambo as they alighted from the coach, conducted them to the bath, and dressed them in robes woven of the down of hummingbirds. After which the great crown officers of both sexes led them to the king's apartment, between 2 files of musicians, 1,000 on each side. When they drew near to the audience chamber, Cacambo asked one of the great officers in what way he should pay his respects to his majesty. Whether they should throw themselves upon their knees or on their stomachs, whether they should put their hands upon their heads or behind their backs, whether they should lick the dust off the floor. In a word, what was the ceremony?
"The custom," said the great officer, "is to embrace the king and to kiss him on each cheek."
Candide and Cacambo threw themselves around his majesty's neck. He received them with all the goodness imaginable and politely invited them to supper. While waiting, they were shown the city, and saw the public edifices raised as high as the clouds, the marketplaces ornamented with 1,000 columns, the fountains of spring water, those of rose water, those of liqueurs drawn from sugarcane, incessantly flowing into the great squares, which were paved with a kind of precious stone, which gave off a delicious fragrancy like that of cloves and cinnamon. Candide asked to see the court of justice, the parliament. They told him they had none, and that they were strangers to lawsuits. He asked if they had any prisons, and they answered no. But what surprised him most, and gave him the greatest pleasure, was the Palace of Sciences, where he saw a gallery 2,000 feet long and filled with instruments employed in mathematics and physics. After rambling about the city the whole afternoon, and seeing but 1,000th part of it, they were reconducted to the royal palace, where Candide sat down to table with His Majesty, his valet Cacambo, and several ladies. Never was there a better entertainment, and never was more wit shown at a table than that which fell from His Majesty. Cacambo explained the king's bon mots to Candide, and notwithstanding they were translated, they still appeared to be bon mots. Of all the things that surprised Candide, this was not the least. They spent a month in this hospitable place. Candide frequently said to Cacambo, "I own, my friend, once more that the castle where I was born is nothing in comparison with this. But after all, Miss Cunegonde is not here, and you have without doubt some mistress in Europe. If we abide here, we shall only be upon a footing with the rest, whereas if we return to our old world, only with 12 sheep laden with the pebbles of El Dorado, we shall be richer than all the kings in Europe. We shall have no more inquisitors to fear, and we may easily recover Miss Cunegonde." This speech was agreeable to Cacambo. Mankind are so fond of roving, of making a figure in their own country, and of boasting of what they've seen in their travels, that the two happy ones resolved to be no longer so, but to ask His Majesty's leave to quit the country.
"You are foolish," said the king. "I am sensible that my kingdom is but a small place, but when a person is comfortably settled in any part, he should abide there. I have not the right to detain strangers. It is a tyranny which neither our manners nor our laws permit. All men are free. Go when you wish, but the going will be very difficult. It is impossible to ascend that rapid river on which you came as by a miracle, and which runs under vaulted rocks. The mountains which surround my kingdom are 10,000 feet high and as steep as walls. They are each over 10 leagues in breadth, and there is no other way to descend them than by precipices. However, since you absolutely wish to depart, I shall give orders to my engineers to construct a machine that will convey you very safely. When we have conducted you over the mountains, no one can accompany you further, for my subjects have made a vow never to quit the kingdom, and they are too wise to break it. Ask me besides anything that you please."
"Oh, we desire nothing of your majesty," said Candide, "but a few sheep laden with provisions, pebbles, and the earth of this country." The king laughed.
I cannot conceive," said he, "what pleasure you Europeans find in our yellow clay. But take as much as you like, and great good may it do you."
At once he gave directions that his engineers should construct a machine to hoist up these two extraordinary men out of the kingdom. 3,000 good mathematicians went to work. It was ready in 15 days, and did not cost more than 20 million sterling in the currency of that country. They placed Candide and Cacambo on the machine. There were 2 great red sheep, saddled and bridled, to ride upon, as soon as they were beyond the mountains, 20 pack sheep laden with provisions, 30 with presents of the curiosities of the country, and 50 with gold, diamonds, and precious stones. The king embraced the 2 wanderers very tenderly. Their departure, with the ingenious manner in which they and their sheep were hoisted over the mountains, was a splendid spectacle. The mathematicians took their leave after conveying them to a place of safety, and Candide had no other desire, no other aim, than to present his sheep to Miss Cunegonde. "Now," said he, "we are able to pay the governor of Buenos Aires if Miss Cunegonde can be ransomed. Let us journey towards Cayenne. Let us embark, and we will afterwards see what kingdom we shall be able to purchase."